You're listening to BSG Theology, a six-month discussion of religion and politics in the 2003 series through a progressive lens. This is episode one of seven, where we will discuss season one. BSG Theology is a limited edition sister podcast to Reclaiming Christianity. If you're a regular listener of Reclaiming Christianity and you don't like sci-fi, might want to press stop now and wait for the next regular episode. So say we all. I'm your host, John Weldy, and I am not a Cylon. You can talk back to us. We have a group on Facebook called the Theology, Sci-Fi, and Fantasy Facebook group. Just search for it there, or there is a link in the show notes. Or you can email me at johnweldy@gmail.com. Not Hotmail. Who the heck uses Hotmail anymore?
Only Cylons.
Hey, I am. I have a Hotmail account.
Cylon. You have a Hotmail account? Freaking way.
That thing from the beginning, man.
All right. So this episode, we're going to be talking about the mini series in season one. Now, we're going to try to keep this since we have people that are watching along with us and some people watching for the first time. We're going to try our best to keep it spoiler free. There are going to be some things that we talk about. Now, when I say spoiler free, in this episode, we're going to be talking about stuff all throughout season one. And by the way, Adama gets shot at the end of season one. Okay, so right there, what? That's a spoiler right there.
No!
all right, so we're going to try to only give spoilers for season one in this one, so you can watch along with us. So if you haven't watched the series yet, maybe watch with us next time, and you can even listen to us, listen to this as we're recording live next month, in about a month. So our panel here, I'm John Weldy, and I'm not a Cylon. We also have Chuck Knight, the hippie heretic. Chuck McKnight, the hippie heretic. Chuck, say hi.
Hey.
And we got Keith Giles, the author of Jesus Untangled. Keith, glad to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Cool. And then we've got Jennifer Neihart from the Theology Book Club for Deconstruction and Reconstruction. How you doing, Jennifer?
Doing all right, John.
All right. So I got a couple questions to ask you guys right up front. First off, how many times have you watched through the series? Chuck, how many times have you watched through it?
So I watched through it one time in its entirety just shortly after the whole thing came out. And then I've mm-hmm. not watched it again until rewatching the first season for this podcast.
Okay. Keith, what about you? How many times have you watched through it?
Yeah, I'm kind of similar to Chuck. I watched it pretty much as it was coming out. I didn't have cable, so I kind of watched it on DVDs or... friends would let me borrow a tape or something. Mm-hmm. And then I just started rewatching it again for this podcast.
All right, cool. So I guess I am the old veteran of this one. I think this is my fourth full watch through. I absolutely love this series. It's fantastic. I watched through the first time. I actually got into it through the board game. And I came into it. I played the board game. I'm a big board gamer. And I played that while we were in the... It was in the fourth season. They had just started season 4.5. And this is back when Netflix had discs. Does Netflix even do discs anymore?
I think so.
They do.
Okay. So discs, that's a strange thing. But I had them mail me like all the discs, and I finished the whole season or the whole show like maybe a month late. So I just completely binged through it the first time. Jennifer, Jennifer, you're our virgin.
Yeah, I forgot I was the only one of the four of us that this was the first time. So, yeah, wow. I just finished watching season one for the first time this week, and I sent John a message as soon as I finished watching it. And I was like, did that just happen? No!
Yeah, and it's funny because in this group that we've got, I just posted something, and I made sure we try to check the spoilers in that group also, and I made sure to post, okay, there's a big, huge spoiler in this. And I thought sure that Jennifer read that and saw Adama got shot and just read it and goes, oh my God, Adama gets shot.
No, I made sure not to read what you had written until after I watched everything. So,
Okay. All righty. So let's get started directly going into it. So why BSG Theology? I mean, we're talking about this from a theological lens. Why talk about theology at Battlestar Galactica? What's the point of that?
Well, because there's so much theology in it. I think anybody who watches it who is, especially if you're a Christian or maybe even a Mormon, you cannot help by the things that come out of the mouth of, honestly, the Cylons. I think that's what, to me, the part of the genius of the show it puts some really provocative statements in the mouths of who are, we think are the villains, the bad guys in the series, the Cylons. Mm-hmm. Although I think later on you become more sympathetic to them. Yeah, I mean, that's what really, one of the things that sucked me into the show was there was this other layer and level and religion going on that was really what made it stand out, which made it different than any other sci-fi show I'd ever seen.
Yeah, I can't really think of a sci-fi show that has this much spirituality and theology. I mean, maybe book, but I can't think of a show that's got this much.
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes from the fact that obviously we're going off of the reboot. The original series was actually created by a Mormon, Glenn Larson. Mm-hmm. And there is tons and tons, even more so in the original series than this one, of Mormon-influenced theology that transfers right over.
So why don't you talk some about that? Because honestly, I'm not that familiar with Mormonism. And I honestly don't know what you're talking about with the Mormon. I've seen the show many, many times. And I've thought through a lot of things, but I haven't delved into the Mormonism in it. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
So I'm not an expert in Mormonism either, just to throw that out there from the get-go. But if you search Battlestar Galactica and Mormonism, you'll get these lists of links, and I've got one up here. I'll just read a couple. And this, again, is based on the original series, but most mm-hmm. of it transfers over. So the colonies have a president and a council, a quorum of 12. That's the same with Mormons.
That's like their church government.
Yeah, and this kind of combined religious political aspect. The colonies originated on planet Kobol. Kobol is a anagram of Kolob, which is the star that the Mormons believe is closest to where God lives.
Okay.
So Mormons believe that the 13 tribes of Israel were scattered over and colonized Earth. The 13th tribe was lost. Again, that parallels with the 13 tribes of Kobol from Battlestar Galactica.
Except they take it and they use the Greek pantheon of gods.
Yeah, now, yeah, the reboot brings in the Greek stuff where that wasn't in the original series.
Yeah, I don't know the original. Actually, I really love the reboot, and I really tried after you know, you get through the whole thing, you're like, oh, I want more, you know, and I tried really hard to get into the original. I just couldn't do it. It's so freaking cheesy.
Yeah, in fairness, I did the same. I've watched half of the original. I haven't gotten the whole way through it.
I watched like half an episode and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. It is. I mean, it's like I can't go back and watch Knight Rider. I can't go back and watch the A-Team. I can't go back and watch Miami Vice, you know. It was so cool back in the day, but I just can't watch it now.
I used to love Miami Vice. Oh my gosh, I was so into that show. And then you're right. Then I watched some reruns recently, and I'm like, man, this show was bad.
Oh, it's so cheesy. And it was like the epitome of cool back then.
So jumping back to Battlestar Galactica for a second here.
the old guy's going on a tangent.
The thing I find interesting with the Mormon influence is that one of the things Mormons are accused of constantly is of being polytheists because of their view of the Trinity and their view of how humans become gods. Now, that's something that if you talk to a Mormon themselves, they will fervently deny it. They do not consider themselves polytheists, but it's a very common accusation against Mormons, generally from Orthodox Christians. So it's fascinating to me that when Glenn Larson designed this Battlestar Galactica world, that he made the protagonist be polytheist, like intentionally polytheist. It's kind of an interesting, like, doesn't that kind of go against what you guys have been saying isn't true this whole time?
On the original series, were they polytheist as well?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I think so.
Yeah, I don't think they were. I think Ron Moore, the guy that did the reboot, and Ron Moore, for sci-fi fans, you might know, he did
a lot of Star Trek, Next Generation.
And he did all the best of that, and then he did all the best of Deep Space Nine as well. And Deep Space Nine was just getting really good when it was canceled. I'm still upset about that. But took over BSG to mix some things up, and I think he introduced the polytheistic stuff because
that could be.
Because he also brought in like the Zodiac and all that stuff too. So I don't think that was in the original BSG.
Interesting. Yeah, that would make more sense.
Yeah, you're saying, Chuck, that I'm sorry, Keith, you said that most of the stuff that really sticks out to you are words coming out of the Cylon's mouth. And I think it's really interesting that you see several different types of theology out of the Cylon's mouth. Like, for instance, Six, we'll get into this more later, you know, but for instance, Six is very much into the loving God type thing. But she's very regimented in her belief system. But then you see like Leoben is very much a mystic, and he has much, much different ideas, but they tie together, but they're different at the same time, you know, and it's really neat seeing through that screen. But at the same time, I see a lot of really interesting things through the polytheistic side of the humans, you know, where like Rosalind has a very interesting faith journey that she goes through. Well, even in the first season, you know, where she's almost agnostic, like, Adama is at the beginning, but at the end of the first season, I mean, she's a dead set believer. I mean, she's certain that she's following this prophecy.
Yeah, and because she has a vision, right? Doesn't she? She has a dream.
Yeah, she has a dream,
and she's dying.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, well, I think it's fascinating too how I forget her name, but the spiritual leader of them is kind of in that same space where, you know, she goes through the motions and she practices this religion, but she doesn't really become a true believer until the visions of Strahd and all that.
Yeah, Priestess Elosha is her name. And yeah, I would not have known that name. I watched the series 4 times. I would have not have known that name unless I looked it up. I mean, she's very distinctive when you see her, you know, but they don't really say her name that many times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was very interesting too. You know, that she says that Rosalind makes her a believer, but she's like the spiritual leader of the whole universe. Of this.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, let's.
Well, you know, I think you touched on something. I think I want to just comment on. Like, you talked about how Six has a very kind of one kind of theology. She's the one that is the first person to say this in the miniseries. She says God is love.
Yes.
Which is, wow, that's a shocking statement. But mm-hmm. then, like you said, Leoben is, like you said, is more mystic. Yeah, and so even within Christianity, you have Augustine and St. Francis. You have, you know what I mean? And or A.W. Tozer and John Piper. Like, these, they're all Christians, but they don't all have the same sort of approach.
Totally.
So I want to applaud Moore and the writers of BSG for bringing in that nuance. Like, they don't make everybody a cookie cutter. Okay, everyone, all the Cylons believe this, and they all believe exactly the same thing. Like, you know, there's nuances even within that faith, and I kind of like that.
Well, yeah. And on the other side, there's nuances also, because there's a huge difference in the theology of Starbuck and of Adama and of Roslyn and of D. Dwala. You know, they're each at different levels in their journeys. I mean, a lot of it with the humans is at different places in their journeys, but maybe there's more of a common thread on what their theology actually is. It's how serious they are with it.
Definitely, yeah.
So I want to take a minute. So this question that I'm going to pop out here right now, this is a question we could talk about for literally hours. Okay, and I don't want to cover it that much because we're going to cover it. I want to get into some of the things from the episodes also, some individual pieces, and this is going to keep coming back over the whole series that we're going to be doing, okay? But this is like the most basic question of the show. When man can create life in his image, because the Cylons were created by man, that's what it says right at the beginning, right? You know, at the beginning of every show. When man can create life in his image, how does this affect theology? And this is kind of like a big question in all of sci-fi, right?
Yeah.
What I think is interesting, though, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I was thinking about that question. And the interesting thing, at least the way they explain it in BSG, is that Cylons, but they didn't create the human looking Cylons, and technically,
Kate, spoiler.
Is that a spoiler?
Yes, that's a spoiler.
No, I already know that.
They said that in the miniseries?
I know it from what I've watched, which is just the miniseries in season one.
Sorry, go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I was just going to say that's what I remember them talking about, how the humans created the ones that looked like the robots or whatever, but then the Cylons themselves were the ones who either evolved somehow or created these the human looking ones, because that's why then the humans didn't even realize that Cylons could look like humans.
Yep.
Okay.
They spend most of season one denying that they can, or like not even sure that they can, and then they have to make the Cylon detector and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, that's a point. Does the Cylon detector work?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think it does either.
I don't think Baltar ever intends for it to work. Maybe it absolutely does. But I was just
I thought it detected that Sharon was a Cylon, but then he didn't tell her. Right.
Yeah,
so it seemed like it worked.
I think that at first he just totally made stuff up, and that was not working.
He's really good at that.
Yeah.
He's but my then favorite.
When Six
He's my favorite character too.
Yeah, he's mine too, actually. when Six gives him the inspiration to use the nuclear warhead for his detector, from my reading of it, that one does work, except that he lies about it anyway. So in practice, it doesn't work because he's lying one way or another. But I think that one does actually detect it.
Did you all say he's your favorite character?
Oh, yes.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I can't stand him.
Oh.
No, dude, he's the best.
I hate him. I mean, he's such a... The way he treats women, his weird thing with Six, the fantasy.
Yes.
I'm not saying he's a good character, but he's the most fascinating character. Yes, he's the most fascinating character, and I like him for that reason.
Okay.
And you'll see...
You know what I love about him?
You'll see also, Jennifer, as we go on, he evolves more than anybody else throughout the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's what I love about him. To me, he's the most human character on the show. And he is so flawed and so, like, how he'll just, you know, fluctuate from one extreme to the other in a heartbeat. And he's so selfish. He's so self-centered. Gosh, I just love him. He's just like the most fascinating and interesting character to me. But even though he's like that, there are moments in the series where he does things that just like blow me away. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he did that. So I love him. I think he's great.
Oh, and he's so wishy-washy. He goes back and forth and back and forth on so many different things. What God does he believe in?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he goes back and forth. Yes, exactly. And most of the time, he just believes in his penis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he really believes in that. Yeah.
Yes. Most definitely. Most definitely. Okay. Do Cylons have souls?
Maybe.
How would that even work?
Hmm.
Okay, what is a soul? Got to figure out that first.
There you go.
Haven't you guys wondered? I think this question is related to the do they have souls question. I mean, don't you wonder? So they are humans. They go off on their own. They're gone for, I don't know how long they're gone, like 10 years or whatever. And they're gone for a long time. And they come back. They've sort of made themselves in the image of their creator.
I think it's 40 years. I think they specifically say 40 years, which is a very interesting time, biblically, of course.
It's a difficult time. But here's the thing. They develop also at the same time, they develop their own theology, which is totally unique. They were exposed to. So it almost is like, well, maybe whatever happened out there in Cylon world, when they were inventing their fleshy selves, maybe they had a connection to the one true God, and he gave them souls in their creation process. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I mean, that's never explained.
Yeah.
But I always wonder, like, where did they even come up with this idea? Like, it's so nowhere. But it's, to me, that's one of the things that makes it really fascinating.
Well, and if you look at the history of religious development in humanity, our actual humanity, it goes from a very polytheistic, like pretty much universally polytheistic sort of religion, gradually to this monotheism.
Yeah.
And it's kind of reflecting the same thing there. You know, the humans who created the Cylons were and still are polytheistic, but the Cylons they created developed that religion further into a monotheistic religion.
And so following that line of thinking, then Baltar is the most evolved human that there is.
Yeah, I guess.
from a theological perspective, maybe. No. In as much as he actually believes it anyway.
So, and there's such a difference. I mean, inherent in this question, do Cylons have souls? There's such a big difference, too, between the human-looking Cylons and the robotic-looking Cylons. And also you learn that the ships, the Raiders are living beings.
Yeah. You know?
So if they do have souls, then is it just Is it just the skin jobs? Is it just the human-looking ones that have souls? Or do the Centurions have souls? Do the Raiders have souls? How does that work exactly? And if the humans have souls, is it one soul per line? Or do they each have a soul? How does that work?
Yeah. Well, so I want to talk about the Sharon Boomer version on Caprica, where it's like she has really fallen in love with, what's his name?
Hilo.
Hilo. And then the reveal that she's pregnant. How can that be possible? But how does all of that relate? That seems important for this question of do they have souls? Because the fact that she seems to really be in love with Hilo seems to be something that would indicate, well, if she has that capacity, I don't know. That seems like a connection to say, yes, she has a soul. But to your question of one soul per line, like that doesn't seem the same as the ones we saw when we saw all of the Sharons on that base. You know, those seemed creepy, clone-like, you know, whatever. And then you've got the version that was on the ship, and I don't know. So it doesn't seem like one soul per line would make sense either, but I don't know.
As a side note, that's the only time that you see so many Cylons naked at one time also. I mean, do they just hang around in that ship all day naked, saying Sharon?
Of course.
My guess is they're supposed to be probably in storage. Like, so when one of them dies and then they need to have a new one churned out, they're ready to go. And for whatever reason, they decide it'd be a good idea to all pop out and say hi to Sharon while she was there.
Well, did they do something to her to trigger what happened at the end?
Or was that the whole thing? You don't know.
Okay.
We don't know at this point in the show.
Okay.
And at this point in the show, you have very, very little idea also about how the Cylon resurrection works. They explain that a whole lot in later season, you know, but we really don't know right now how the Cylon resurrection works. You do say, like, right at the beginning in the miniseries, when Leoben is on, what is it, the Ragnar station, and he has the radiation sickness, and Adama starts talking to him about, well, maybe you're so far out that you can't resurrect.
Yeah.
You know, so we know a little bit about it, but we don't really know much about it.
Yeah, later. How does Adama know about the resurrection thing?
That's a good question, too.
Well, one of the Cylons, I forget which, explained to them how their memory or consciousness or whatever would upload to, I don't know what you call it, but it would transfer over and have that. They didn't go into detail, but they did make that mention in passing. So that's probably what Adama's going off of.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hit some pieces. We're only going to have time, you know, here and there to do some bits and pieces about what happened in the show. But there's some really interesting pieces that I just want to kind of read off some quotes from the show and stuff like that. And then just any comments that you have on them. In the miniseries, one of the things that was really super interesting to me is at the end of the miniseries, Adama makes this big, it's the beginning. At the beginning of the miniseries, when they're decommissioning the Battlestar Galactica, Adama makes this big speech. He says, "The Cylon War is long over, yet we must not forget the reasons why so many sacrifice so much in the cause of freedom. The cost of wearing the uniform can be high." And then he looks at the crowd and says, "But sometimes it's too high." He goes off script at this time. "You know, when we fought the Cylons, we had to save ourselves from extinction, but we never answered the question, why? Why are we as a people worth saving? We still commit murder because of greed, spite, jealousy. And we still visit all of our sins upon our children. We refuse to accept the responsibility for anything that we've done, like we did with the Cylon. We decided to play God, create life. When that life turned against us, we comforted ourselves in the knowledge that it wasn't really our fault. Not really. You cannot play God, then wash your hands of the things that you've created. Sooner or later, the day comes when you can't hide from the things that you've done anymore."
Yeah.
There's a lot to process in that. What stands out to me initially is the concept of divine culpability. Stepping back from the humans who created the Cylons, looking at the God that we all worship, is God culpable for creating humans who then do all these horrible things? You know, is God in some way guilty for that? It's a fascinating theological concept to delve into that will get you quickly kicked out of Orthodox circles, but I think it's a worthwhile thing to talk about.
about that?
What?
Hello?
We're still here. Everyone just stopped talking.
I asked a question. Yeah. So do we want to go there? Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's funny because like this is such a thorny problem, right? It's the problem of evil, right? If God is good, right. why does he allow evil and all that? And I had to talk to someone about this. I think we sat down for dinner and we talked for like 2 hours straight and never solved anything. But I've been lately been really interested, and maybe you guys have read some of the books by Thomas J. Ord.
Yep.
Controlling Love of God. Mark Harris has a book as well called Divine Echoes, where he also kind of talks about this. And then, so this idea is more along the lines, kind of takes the idea that God is love, primarily God is love, and God is uncontrolling love. Therefore, God is not in control. God does not control people. God does not control events. Created us. He gave us free will and agency. And we're the ones who do evil, right? And so, which mm-hmm. we know that. We're the ones who do the evil. And so we're the ones who can stop it. I just think it's an interesting way to look at it. Again, it takes God off the hook, but it also, it kind of reframes your view of God. And what does it mean to say then, set God in terms of love and not in the terms of power? The idea that God is all powerful. God can do anything he wants. He can do whatever he wants within his character.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of things he can't do because it violates his character. Mm-hmm. And if it's true that God is love and God is uncontrolling love, he's not the one responsible for this. So what he's responsible for is giving us news, and what we've done with it has been the tragedy.
Yeah. So Adama's kind of saying all that in a nutshell right here. You know, I mean, it's really interesting that they have Adama kick this off, you know, because you find out later Adama, really Adama's an agnostic, if not an atheist. You know, if he believes in the gods in any way, shape, or form, you know, it's way beneath there in the number of things that he believes. But it's interesting that he's the first one of the series to bring up sin. He talks about the many sins and how we visit them upon our children, you know, and that's got a dual meaning, of course, for him because he's actually talking about Zach's death at that time, and also the problems that he's got with his strained relationship with Lee. But he also talks about the Cylon being humanity's children.
Yeah, I see Adama as being kind of an equivalent to a liberal Christian, not liberal as in progressive, but as in theological liberal. He utilizes the framework of their religious beliefs, and he goes along with it in terms of ceremony and as a way of life, but he doesn't seem to give any credence whatsoever to the supernatural aspect of it. He doesn't believe the prophecies are literally fulfilled. That sort of stuff is just myth and legend to him, but he's still culturally of a part of that religion and accepts it in as much as that goes.
See, I don't know that he even accepts it. I think he uses it as a tool to guide people. I think he's almost a humanist. So there's a line when they're on Ragnar Station. We talked about this a little bit earlier. When Adama and Leoben are on Ragnar Station, Leoben says, "Maybe the Cylons are God's retribution for our many sins. What if God decided he made a mistake?" And this is where Adama doesn't know that Leoben's a Cylon yet. "Maybe the Cylons are retribution for our many sins. What if God decided he made a mistake and then decided to give souls to another creature like the Cylon?" And then Adama says, "God didn't create the Cylons, man did. And I'm pretty sure we didn't include a soul in the programming." So that kind of speaks to our what we were talking about a little bit earlier. So it sounds like in Leoben's mind that this is what actually happened. So Leoben is saying that God, so the Cylons did not have souls and God gave them a soul because man screwed up.
Actually, I kind of cheated and I watched Ron Moore did a presentation
uh-huh.
at a university and it specifically talked about faith and BSG. Talked about this a little bit. He said that kind of like what he was kind of shooting for was this idea things were flawed. And, you know, they're the ones who have sin, basically. They've got their flaws. Cylons are the next sort of evolution in life and in the one true God. And so they believe that God has given them the mandate to basically fix the mistake. And that's why they go back and attack Caprica, is that in their minds, God has basically given them, if you'll be honest. And to be honest, by the way, when BSG came out, it was very soon after 9/11.
Yes.
And some of that is what's bleeding into, it's sort of like these religious fanatics, and those would be the Cylons, who feel like it's their God-given duty to declare jihad against the infidels, and the infidels being, you know, multiple, you know, God polytheistic humans who are so flawed and so screwed up that they have to basically fix that mistake.
Well, even putting aside Islamic theology for a minute and going to our own Judeo-Christian heritage, it's the same thing as Joshua's conquest of Canaanite or the medieval churches, you know, the Crusades. It's the same thing that repeats over and over again in our own history as well, believing that God commands us to do these horrible things, that the God of love supposedly wants us to go wipe out all these people.
To the Cylons, sorry. I was going to ask, do the Cylons say that they believe God is the one? I guess they do, right? That they think God is wanting them to wipe out the humans and everything.
Yeah, six definitely does. That's where we really get this fundamentalist theology from, is six. Because really the only two Cylons, so the Cylons that we have so far, we have six, who is the hot smoking blonde. We have Boomer, who's the eight. And she doesn't really talk about theology, like maybe never. I don't know that she really talks about it at all, at least in the first season. We have Leoben, who is the mystic. We have Doral. And Doral doesn't really talk about theology either. Do we have another Cylon yet?
Which one was Doral?
Doral is the reporter from the beginning in the miniseries.
Okay.
When they're on Caprica, Doral and Six talk together a lot.
He's been on screen fairly little so far.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't remember. Not a ton. So really the only two theologies that we have from the Cylons are like this retributive God. God is love, but at the same time, God is okays you to kill people, which Six has, the fundamentalism. And then we have the mysticism that Leoben has. You know, like there's some really interesting things that Six says. Let me pull out a couple of them. In the first episode, 33, she says, procreation is one of God's commandments. That's interesting. Procreation is a commandment.
Yeah.
Go
and multiply, right?
Yeah. That which God gives, he can also take away. She says that also. I got some other ones here, you know, but yeah, she's the fundamentalist.
Yeah.
I think I heard you say, John, or maybe you wrote something about, is Cylon theology simply American Calvinism? And I do see a connection there, and maybe it's just that fundamentalist bent that, you know, that makes the connection, but I think too the whole God has a specific plan for your life, Gaius. You know that she tells him in the later episodes. That seems to be in line with the determinism of Calvinism as well.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely the deterministic element in Cylon theology. What we've seen of it so far. I'm kind of hesitant to press it into Calvinism much more than the determinism aspect, simply because Calvinism is so heavily soteriological, based on salvation. And for Calvinism, that means salvation from hell, from God's wrath. And I don't see any element of that at all in Cylon theology, at least what we've seen so far. I don't remember if maybe some of that comes up.
Did they talk about salvation at all? I don't think they do.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. Put yourself in the mind of a Cylon, and when you die, what happens to you? You know exactly what happens to you when you die. You get resurrected.
You come right back, yeah.
There's no sort of afterlife you're being saved from there, and that's where it really deviates from Calvinism, in my opinion.
Yeah.
From, yeah.
So, well, then in six is my, so six is a really interesting character. She's so manipulative. And also this six that's in Gaius's mind, you don't really know what she is exactly. Is she real? Is she doing something? Is she just a figment of his imagination? You know, so most of these conversations, in fact, maybe all of the theological conversations in the first season that six has are between her and Gaius when she's this figment of the imagination type thing that you don't really know what it is, you know? So
or whatever. Yeah. She's a vision. She's an angel. And actually that's what I love about that whole thing is that we don't know what's going on. We don't know if Gaius is just losing his mind.
Yep. Which is
or he's having, they've done something to put some kind of a, they have some way of speaking to him in a way that, you know, no one else can see it or hear it.
You know, it's interesting. In watching the show, I've kind of been watching it from the perspective that somehow or another she did like implant herself into his brain and is actually there in some sort of real sense. And that's kind of been the framework I've been watching it from. But if that's not true, if she totally is a figment of his imagination and he's just completely making her up there, then he is actually converting himself to Cylon theology totally apart from the Cylons.
Yes.
Well, that doesn't make sense. How would he even know about it?
Doesn't make sense, exactly.
He wouldn't know where to get it from, which is that's why I think you have to say that somehow Six is really giving him information about the Cylon theology and the Cylon viewpoint. Otherwise, where would he ever get it from?
Or that the Cylon God is the true God and is speaking to him through the visions of Six.
So maybe Six is the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
See, there's an if the Cylons have implanted something inside of Gaius and Six is really there talking to him, then I've got two words that throw a wrench into that. Shelley Godfrey. Because he comes up against, there's that episode where this lady, Shelley Godfrey, that is Six, comes up and is talking to him and she plants something in the CIAC in Galactica. She's accusing him and she doesn't know anything about him, or at least she claims to. She's putting on a really good act if she actually knows who he is.
So is she, though, the same Six? Because the Six that is in his brain, whatever that is, disappears for the entirety of the time that the physical Six is there.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Well, and that was the whole reaction to Gaius's blasphemy, right? That he didn't believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
And then she disappears from his fantasy or his mind or whatever, and the physical one that everybody can see is on the ship. And so I don't know.
Go ahead. Well, they never find her, do they? I don't know if I don't remember if she comes back up later in the series, but so far,
Shelley Godfrey never comes up.
So what is she? Where'd she come from? Where'd she go?
Good question.
Good night, Joe.
You know what I thought the moment I said that, the moment it came out of my mouth, I finished it in my head, and then you finished it out loud for me.
Yeah, that's an awesome episode. I love that one. It's really neat. And I just love, this is one of the reasons why Gaius is so interesting, because you have to figure whatever this Six is. I figure that into Gaius's character even more than Six.
What do you mean?
Because, I mean, I've watched the whole thing several times, so I know what she is. But, I mean, at this point in the show, it really feels like she's a figment of his imagination. That would be my theory at this point. And that was my theory the first time I was watching through it, that she's all in his head.
Well, that was what I was thinking, too, except for the stuff she says about God and what we've been talking about with the Cylon theology. Why and how would Gaius be pulling that out of thin air unless the Cylon God is the true God and is somehow speaking to him, like we said. So that makes me think there's something more going on here than just his weird brain.
That's a good way of putting it. So let's talk about Leoben's theology. Okay, so Leoben is much more the mystic. He talks to Adam at the beginning. I gave that line. Maybe the Cylons are God's retribution for our many sins. But the big episode where you really get a big dose of Leoben's theology are when Kara Thrace is interrogating him. They find a copy of Leoben, and she interrogates him. This is episode 8, Flesh and Bone. And they really get into what are Cylons. Are they people or are they machines? And Adama is certain that they're completely machines. And I believe Carrot is also certain that they're machines, because the way that she tortures Leoben, Kira Thrace, she's an amazing character. Okay, Starbuck is an amazing character.
I love her. She's my favorite.
She's brilliant. But and she has this thing of theology in her also, where she's got a background in a spiritual upbringing, but most of the time she believes in herself. You know, she's very into her own abilities and she doesn't take life too seriously. But I don't think she's the type of person who would torture another human being like she tortures Leoben. I don't think she, even with as much as duty means to her, I don't think she would do that. I think she's really solid that Leoben is a machine.
A toaster.
Until he gets put out the airlock, and then she has all these second thoughts.
Yeah. She does. Yeah. She does. So some of the things that Leoben says, so at one point Leoben and Kara are first talking, Kara says, I don't think the gods answer the prayers of toasters, because Leoben is praying when Kara first comes in. And Leoben says, God answers everyone's prayers, you know, so this is, he gets to the loving God like Six does to a point also. One of the lines he says, to know the face of God is to know madness. Is that like a famous quote or something? It seems like I've heard that someplace. Like Karl Marx thing.
I don't know.
No?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've not heard that.
Okay. No. And then another one, he says, what is the most basic article of faith? This is not all that we are.
I like that. I like that line.
He goes into this long spiel about what Cylon resurrection is, and nobody else really explains Cylon resurrection, but I mean, you'd think that it would be this mechanical process, that it would just happen, but Leoben talks about it in this mystical sense, maybe like a reincarnation sense, you know, where it's a big thing. It's like, it sounds like he's a part of a hive mind or a central consciousness, although we don't have any conception of that from anybody else. Like, for instance, take Shelley Godfrey and the Six that's in Gaius's head. There's no sense that they share consciousness at all.
Well, and there's the one on Caprica too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, so you know what? I don't know that they share consciousness like real time. Like something on Galactica, the other one on Caprica can pick it up on a wavelength or something. Or even if they're staying next to each other, that they, it's not like telepathy or like, I think it's only that when one of them dies, that model's memories get sort of added to the stream somehow. But I think that's the only way. I think that's the only way the show kind of explains it. Because I don't think you ever see any other examples of like looking at each other and having the same thought or having this information.
Yeah, they do delve into that a whole lot more in further seasons, and it's really, I mean, the eights. I mean, look at the eights. There's no sense at all that Hilo's eight and the eight that's on the Galactica have any kind of linked consciousness. I mean, the Hilo's eight obviously knows that she's a Cylon, but she's falling in love with Hilo and she's trying to escape. But the one that's on Galactica doesn't know anything about being a Cylon until boom, she's tricked. I mean, she suspects it. But then, boom, she's triggered as a sleeper agent.
Well, and I felt so bad for her for both of those versions. Yeah. For both the one in love with Hilo that knows she's a Cylon and the one that's been struggling with starting to suspect it. I've had so much empathy for that character. And then she's triggered and you're like, no! So, it's interesting.
Yeah, she's a really interesting character. Back to Leoben and Starbuck in the interrogation chamber. This exchange I absolutely love. Leoben says, we're all God, Starbuck, all of us. I see the love that binds us all together. If that's not something mystical, I don't know what is.
Well, and that goes,
oh my God.
But it also struck me as odd, because to say we're all God doesn't sound like a typical monotheist type position.
It's like Hindu. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not panentheism. Panentheism is God is in all things. Pantheism is all things are God.
Right.
Pantheism then, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely is.
Well, and it seems to me that six, at least the version in Gaius's head, it almost seemed like she was acting like she was God at times with him, even though she didn't say that. She didn't say, "I'm God," but I don't know.
She definitely acts with authority. She bullies him around like crazy, you know, sometimes with physical strength, which it's awesome that she's like a foot taller than, you know, I mean, that's great. Mm-hmm. But sometimes with her sexuality, you know, she just bullies him around and controls him everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah,
that's another thing I think is interesting is how she is a fundamentalist all the way down the line, except for her sexual ethic, which is completely opposite. Completely.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, they have absolutely no problem killing, you know, genocide mm-hmm. of entire, you know. But then again, yeah, like you're saying, that's a fundamentalist thing. That's,
yeah, that goes hand in hand with at least some forms of fundamentalism.
Yep.
Yep. Somebody will burn you forever, and we're going to bomb the crap out of you because he told us to.
Right. Okay, so after Leoben says, "We're all God, Starbuck, all of us, I see the love that binds us all together." Starbuck says, "You don't even know what the word means." And Leoben says, "I know that God loved you more than all other living creatures, and you repaid his divine love with sin, with hate, corruption, evil." So then he decided to create the Cylons. He doesn't even give man the credit for creating Cylons. He says God created the Cylons. Then Starbuck says, "You slaughtered my entire civilization. That is evil. You are evil." Leoben says, "Am I? I see the truths that flow past you in the stream."
Yeah.
Is he screwing with her here, or is this like what he believes?
Yeah, look, Leoben, what I love about Leoben is devious, man.
Yeah.
He's actually, that's what I like about his character. To me, he's very much like a Lucifer character. Like, he'll tell you a lot of truth, be really honest with you, right? And then there's just that little bit of a lie
mm-hmm.
or that little bit of a manipulation, enough to make you, like, second guess and back up and go, wait a minute, what did that mean? I mean, to me, that's Leoben is tricky.
What just struck me, John, is when you said, you know, does he really believe that? And it made me think, if he's a Cylon, can any of the Cylons, what does it mean to say this is what they believe versus have they been programmed to believe a certain thing? Did the humans program them to believe anything? Or is, I mean, and then I don't know. And how that relates to when the Cylons evolved or, I don't remember. The language they used in the show, I think, was that they evolved, but that doesn't make as much sense to me as the idea that somehow the Cylons managed to create these human versions, the ones that look like humans. But either way, it seems like there's programming involved. So that's an interesting thing to think about in terms of what it means to believe something versus if you're programmed to believe something, and then you can have discussions about how we as humans are programmed to believe things in the way that we're brought up and culturally conditioned all of that.
Yes, actually that I didn't even think about that. I love that idea of like, yeah, the humans talk to the Cylons like, "Oh, you have programming." Like we don't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. It's very interesting. Like, well, no, we program our children, right, with culture and with education and with religion and politics, and right, we're programmed, and so it's like, oh no, it's not, we're free thinkers, or do we? Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what Leoben is talking about. It's like, yeah, come on, look at yourself, be more honest about who are as human beings. You're capable of this same kind of evil that you're accusing the Cylons of.
I think this is really huge in the character of Kara Thrace also, because I mean, you look at most of the characters that are the human characters, most of the human characters are involved with the military. I mean, there's civilian government also, but it's mostly military that the show focuses on. And so obviously there's programming in the military, but in the person of Kara Thrace, she's the rebel. She's the one that stands out. So she would say, "Oh, I'm not really conditioned that much by my military training because I do these things differently. I stand out, you know." But at the same time, at an even deeper base level on that, when she's really pushed, like for instance, when she's on the planet and she finds the raider, when she's clearly away from everything, she has no chance of survival. What does she do? She prays. That's the first time you ever hear her pray to the gods, you know? Now, as soon as she sees the raider, she's back into Kira Thrace mode and she's on her own, you know? But you could say that that's a programming that she has also that's deeply inside of her, that she's programmed at a very base level to trust in the gods. So this is also where Leoben tells Kara that she'll find Kobol, and that triggers the end of the season, which is really cool. And like you said before, Chuck, at the end of this episode, after Leoben has put out the airlock, you know, and Roslyn, oh man, Roslyn totally plays him, and she is stone cold.
Oh yeah.
Oh man! I mean, she can, for a kindergarten teacher, she can make the choices when she needs to make a choice.
Yeah, don't put down teachers, man.
Oh my gosh! But yeah, she completely plays him, and Roslyn is completely in the camp also. Where they're definitely machines. Just do whatever you can do to use them and throw them away. But Kara is not so sure, because at the end of the episode, she prays to the gods about him. She said, I think he's probably just in case, which is very interesting. That's really the first sympathy you see towards the Cylons, other than Baltar.
Yeah, totally. I just want to say too that Roslyn is also one of my favorite characters.
She
such a feminist badass. I love it.
I love her too.
Yeah, me too. She's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many amazing characters in this show. That's why the show is so great. It's a character show. I mean, that's the reason why I watch it so many times. I mean, we're talking about the theology in it, and the theology is awesome, but it's a character show.
Yeah.
The plot is great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But it's a character.
Well, yeah, that's what blew me away. I think it was still early in the season when it was after Kara came clean with Adama about passing his son through pilot school when she shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And so then his reaction to that, and then when she almost dies and she's in the hospital, or not the hospital, but she's in the recovery area, and when he comes back and they have that moment of reconciliation. I mean, just such powerful moments to me, just on the story level alone, that really, I think that's when I was like, okay, I'm hooked. I'm in. I love this show.
So in the last few episodes, we get some of the sacred. Well, there's a few places where we get little bits and pieces out of their sacred scrolls. I'm talking about the human sacred scrolls. Like at the beginning in the miniseries, we hear the first words of the sacred scrolls. I mean, obviously, we have in the beginning, God created the heavens, the earth. For the humans, their sacred scrolls start with life here began out there. And that really plays to what you were talking about earlier with the Mormonism tie-in, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a big carryover right there.
There's some other places where we get the sacred scrolls, especially at the end. This is out of season, or out of episode 10. Priestess Alosha reads, 3,600 years ago, Pythia wrote about the exile and rebirth of the human race, and the lords anointed a leader to guide the caravan of the heavens to their new homeland. And unto the leader they gave a vision of serpents numbering 2 and 10 as a sign of things to come. And Roslyn plays into that, of course.
So I just had an interesting thought about the parallels, even just between, you know, thinking about the Exodus story, you know, the exile of the Israelites and the Babylonian exile of the Israelites in the Old Testament. And I don't know, I don't know how intentional those allusions are, but it's something I thought of just now. And then even with the numbering 2 and 10 of the serpents, and thinking again of like the 12 tribes in the Old Testament. And so I don't know, I would think that some of that's intentional imagery and intentional references to key numbers and things like that. But
absolutely intentional. I think all of that, I think for sure Glenn Larson, who did the original series, when he came up with all this stuff, was, I think Ronald Moore, when he was doing the reboot, was very much wanting, you know, key off of all of that and bring all of that in, because it's like this ready-made sort of lore tap into, and all you have to do is tweak it a little bit and make it your own. And then you've got all this deep and rich stuff to mine and to draw from.
All right.
I think that's definitely on purpose.
Yeah.
So while we're kind of talking about their scripture for a second, I wanted to hit on something that I actually didn't notice in the show, but John, I saw it in your notes you wrote about their scripture having pictures in it and whether or not those pictures are a part of their scripture.
Mm-hmm.
That's really intriguing to me. If you think about our Christian scriptures, especially in the Eastern Orthodox branch, icons are, they wouldn't call them scripture, but they're almost scripture. St. Gregory, the dialogist, spoke of icons as being scripture to the illiterate. They're like a form of scripture, but not quite. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting that you brought that up with the...
Yeah, and that's at a place actually where Elosha is talking. So that's when they're going to go back to Caprica to get the arrow, because they need the arrow to go to a certain place on Kobol. And Elosha pulls out a picture of Kobol that's in the scripture. She says it's here in the scriptures, and she pulls out this map. And I mean, I'm, you know, in our Christian Bible, the 67th book is the book of maps. I mean. But I don't know if it's that or if they actually see this map as part of their scripture.
It's a really intriguing question to ponder anyway. I don't know if we get a definitive answer, but cool to think about.
And we find out that Kobol is the birthplace of mankind, where the gods and man lived in paradise together. And it's the birthplace of the 13 tribes. That's interesting, the gods and man living together.
Well, isn't that the Garden of Eden, right? In the beginning, God walked right with man in the cool of the day in the garden. Mm-hmm. And all they've done is add 12 more gods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the same kind of idea.
And the thing that we get all throughout all the rest of the show, all this has happened before and all this will happen again. And the way Rosalind described it, this saying comes over and over. It keeps hitting you over and over. All this has happened before and all this will happen again. The way Rosalind puts that, if you believe in the gods, then you believe that we're all playing our parts of a story that is played over and over again throughout eternity.
It feels kind of...
That line, where that came from?
So, sorry, go ahead.
The line, all of this has happened before and all of this will happen again, where it came from is Peter Pan.
What?
How so?
It's the first line from the Disney animated Peter Pan film, Sebastian Cabot, at the very beginning. The very first words that are spoken, I think, as the narrator is at the beginning of that Disney cartoon for Peter Pan, he says, all of this has happened before, and all of this will happen again. And then he tells you the story of Peter Pan.
I would have never, ever gotten that.
So Brad Jerzak actually commented on a post on my Facebook wall, so the one saying we're going to do this podcast, saying that that's from Nietzsche. I don't know much of anything about Nietzsche. According to Brad, that's where that comes from.
According to Ron Moore, that's where he took it from. that's where he says he took it from. He said he was watching with his kid, and that's the first line. And he said, "I'm going to use that."
Yeah, I don't doubt that. But I wonder if Peter Pan took that from Nietzsche then. However, that all plays out.
Sure.
If so, that's bizarre that they're quoting Nietzsche at Peter Pan.
So you've got this idea that this is like the central idea of the human scriptures, is that history is this big thing that plays out and we all play our parts in it. You know, it's deterministic. You know, we don't really have a choice. We all play our parts and it just happens over and over, and we play those parts and it keeps happening again and again and again. So, I mean, we know what the Cylon afterlife is like. They're resurrected right away. I wonder if this means that the human afterlife is that you're just born again to play another part in the story.
Reincarnation.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting, because I don't think the humans ever talk about it. Do the humans ever talk about what they believe happens when they die?
Not that I know of. Not that I recall.
which is really weird.
Well, it's very interesting that there's so much theology in the show and we don't really talk about soteriology.
Right.
Yeah. This could be totally random, but I'm just thinking too about the name Cylon kind of parallels etymologically cycle, you know, the same thing happening again. Could just be a total random coincidence, but
yeah,
interesting.
Well, and that's kind of what they are. It's a recreation of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
It's another cycle.
Exactly.
I keep thinking about that quote from Rosalind, though, about, you know, that we're all just playing our parts in a story that's played again and again throughout eternity. It, to me, that strikes me as, well, how meaningless then if it's deterministic and if it's just going to happen over and over again, why does it matter what I do? Do I have a choice in what I do? I don't know. It strikes me as making things feel more meaningless.
Well, I think you can dig into that by digging into Adama's character a little bit. We haven't really talked about Adama very much in this, but what drives Adama? I mean, because Adama's not driven by these strong theological forces. He's not driven by a strong belief in God. What drives him?
Patriotism.
Okay, yeah. Nation.
Yeah. He's got that duty and that loyalty both to his role, his job, to humanity, and then to his family, we've seen as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the other thing is that the family. You know, I mean, the patriotism, the duty, but I think the family is a really big thing also. You know, you think back to the episode where Kara is stranded, you know, and he extends the search way too long. It doesn't make sense to be searching for her, you know, because she's his surrogate daughter. You know, and right. Then there's that part at the end of the episode where Lee is talking to him, you know, and it's like, well, if it was me, how long would you extend that search? Because they actually stopped the search. And Lee says, if it was me, how long would you stop that search? And Adama looks right in his eyes and says, if it was you, we would never leave. So literally, for his family, for his flesh and blood, Adama would throw away all of human civilization. And I believe that he would do that.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So to answer your question with that, Jennifer, it's not, I mean, yes, they're playing a part. They're playing a role, but there's some very real other motivations in that, you know, and Adama really, really brings that out. You know, the motivations of family, the motivations of duty, it's what keeps him going.
Right.
I think too, we can look at that whole, the cycle, the reoccurring thing as a grand narrative, grand scheme sort of thing. But that doesn't mean that every individual character, every player is an exact rehash of one who's come before. The ebb and flow of civilization, and even in our own world, we can definitely see that things do tend to go through the same motions over and over again. But every time it happens, it's different. It's not a cookie cutter. All the individual players are unique and worthwhile in themselves, even though we're doing much of the same things over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, history repeats itself, but people don't.
I was going to say, I think that's really, to me, that's what I took from that whole statement of, you know, everything has happened and again. It's basically a defeatist, that proverb that, you know, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. It just says, no, we're doomed to repeat it no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
It's biblical too, you know, there's nothing new under the sun.
True.
All right. Well, I think that's all that I've really got for this first episode. Is there anything really burning in you on season one of the miniseries that you want to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
I can't think of anything.
All righty. So then let's go ahead and sign off then. We're going to be doing this again in probably about a month. We'll have to figure out exactly when the recording time is. But if you want to follow along with us, if you want to watch with us, then the next episode is going to be about the first half of season two, episodes 1-10 of season two. And that'll come up probably in about a month is when we'll do the podcast. If you want to join with us, it's the Theology, Sci-Fi, and Fantasy Facebook group. You can just search for Theology, Sci-Fi, Fantasy on Facebook. Or you can send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. I will be happy to join you into that. Or you can find any one of our panelists, Chuck McKnight, Keith Giles, Jennifer Neihart, or myself, John Weldy.
I just want to throw out one quick correction there. If you search theology, sci-fi, fantasy, it won't necessarily come up. Spell it out, theology, science fiction, fantasy. That'll bring it up.
I'll make sure to get that right in the show. I do have a links in the show notes too. So if you downloaded this podcast and just want to click into the show notes,
yeah, see the link will work. Okay, but if you search that, it actually won't come up, at least not very soon.
All right. So, Chuck McKnight, where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on my Pathos blog, Hippie Heretic. You can also go directly to that via hippieheretic.com. That's the main two places.
All right. Keith, where can people find you? Keith Giles, where can people find you?
Yeah, well, I'm on Pathos also, or you can just go to keithgiles.com. That's my blog. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, and I also use Hotmail, sorry to say. By the way, I also get the discs from Netflix. That's how old I am. And wow. You can also follow me on
the Heretic. You still get discs?
And you can follow me on the Heretic Happy Hour podcast as well.
Wow. See, I'm about ready to get an HD TV, a 4K TV, and I'm going to have to pay a couple extra bucks for a Netflix to get some 4K support. And it's amazing. I didn't even know they still did discs.
I think they mainly do discs for the ones that don't have license to stream. It's just an option to still rent them.
I got you.
They actually have a better selection on discs than they do on streaming. That's why I keep.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Yeah,
I'm sure they do. Yeah, I've got Hulu and Amazon also, you know, so I've got way too much stuff that I'll ever watch. Jennifer Neihart, where can people find you?
JenniferNeihart.com. That's NEYHART. Also on Twitter and Facebook. Just look me up.
All right. And I'm John Weldy. You can find me at ReclaimingChristianity.net or check this feed for our next episode. So, until next time, friends, good hunting and Godspeed. So say we all.
So say we all.
So say we all.